This is Spectrum.
Alternative Myths, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information.
Hey guys, how you doing? Our guest this week is Theo Chalmers, who's been peering down the rabbit hole for decades now. From October 2008 until June 2010, Theo Chalmers hosted On the Edge, the most popular show on Edge Media controversial TV. Sky Channel 200 broadcast by satellite across Europe, making 75 shows in all. His new and current show, called One Step Beyond, was first broadcast on the 6th of September 2011 and is live every week at 8 p.m. on Tuesdays, with repeats every Wednesday at 9 p.m. His old On the Edge shows can be seen every day at 1 p.m. on the same channel. The show features interviews with recognized experts and iconoclasts, many of them politicians, scientists, activists, authors, and filmmakers, chosen for their alternative radical thinking on diverse subjects and conspiracy theories. Chalmers likes to claim that if you have an inquiring mind, these programs will not fail to feed your brain. Also, hang out at the end of the show, at the end of this interview, I have a pre-interview that I did with Lloyd Pye that's just a quick little update talking about the Star Child skull and an amazing new discovery that could lead to absolute proof that the Star Child skull is not human. So hang in at the end for that. Hello, Theo.
Hello, Scott.
I'm glad to have you on the show. Looking forward to our discussion.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, what I want to do is I want to ask you, first of all, how did you get interested in the subjects that you talk about on your TV show?
Oh, well, I've been interested in alternative thinking, I suppose, for a very long time. You know, I was interested in things like Erich von Däniken a long time ago and, you know, kind of what's really going on in the world. I've always felt myself to be somebody who doesn't accept things at face value. And, you know, once you start looking in those kind of areas, it becomes more and more obvious that we're not being told the truth, that the mainstream media deliberately lies to us for its own ends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I say, the more you look, the more you find. I wish it were not so. I'd like to live in a planet where everybody cares about everybody else and you only ever get the truth. But sadly, that's not the planet I'm living on. So,
yeah,
you know.
I hear you. Did it happen, like, when you were young, when you were a teenager, did you have these sort of thoughts as well, or was it later on you sort of fell into it?
No. I've always had these thoughts. I've always felt that, you know, there's a kind of veil over everything. You know, it's a bit like The Wizard of Oz, you know, when they pull back the curtain and there's the old guy being the wizard. You know, I've always felt that we're kind of being told a set of things that are not necessarily true. And as I say, the more you look at those things, the more you see that that's the case. And, you know, we all live our lives directed by the mainstream media to believe certain things, which upon closer examination very often are lies. You know, and it's happening right now, for instance. So, you know, I mean, the drums of war, for instance, with war with Iran, are beating incredibly loudly right now.
And, yeah.
You know, the International Atomic Energy Authority is making a big fuss about Iran, but has it ever investigated Dimona in Israel? Has Israel ever submitted itself to inspection?
Right.
Well, funnily enough, no. So, you know, how come they're the good guys and the Iranians, who've never declared war on anybody, are the bad guys? You can ask yourself the question, you know, what have they got that the world wants to invade them for? Oh, they've got lots of oil. What a coincidence. Just like Iraq, you know, we were stupid enough, not, well, you know, I, obviously didn't believe it. I'm sure you didn't, but you know, the world was stupid enough to accept that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and therefore they must, you know, that they could launch it, you know, in half an hour or whatever, 20 minutes. That was a lie. Has anyone been convicted for, you know, starting an illegal war, invading an innocent country and killing its leader? Apparently not.
Right, yeah. The rules sort of change depending upon which country's, you know, doing the act, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, America feels that it has some sort of divine right to bully the world. And, you know, I find that difficult to accept.
Well, they get lots of help, too, don't they?
Well, they get help from the British, actually.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it is an interesting thing to look at, because the drums are definitely beating right now. I don't know if there's a video on YouTube. A lot of people have seen it, about somebody basically coming on and giving the propaganda speech about they're setting it up. They're setting up the play. You could hear all of the keywords. They're throwing around the nuclear device, terrorism, attack Israel, basically setting up the preemptive you know, strike that's probably going to happen against Iran. You know, I've had insiders tell me that it's a done deal.
I agree. I mean, if you look at the map of the Middle East, if you look at the, you know, this, Iran is supposed to be a country that's threatening the world. But if you look at America's military bases that surround Iran, they have military bases in the Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Oman, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Turkey, and Iraq. I mean, they absolutely are surrounding Iran with military bases, not to mention the battleships in the Gulf, right. You know, in the Straits of Hormuz and so on. And yet it's Iran that's supposedly threatening the world. Well, you know, Iran has never invaded another country. The last war it was in was a war with Iraq that was inspired and funded by America, and which they won to defend themselves from the Iraqis. So, you know, I don't think they're the aggressor. I think they're the victim.
Right, and they're just being used as these are chess pieces, in my opinion. These are just chess pieces, and the chess pieces are being moved around the board. And you can call them anything you want, right?
Yeah, that's what Zbigniew Brzezinski said, you know, the grand chess game.
Right, exactly. His quote. We can take it from him, I guess.
Well, he's one of the people like Kissinger, and he, you know, started illegal wars and many times and imposed their own puppet governments and removed democratically elected people from power. Like Allende in Chile, for instance, you know, it just goes on and on and on, and the mainstream media never says anything. It's like they blindly parrot what they're told to say by the powers that be.
Yeah, journalism, true journalism, is, I wouldn't say it's dead, but it's suffering from mortal wounds. And what's happening is now what they do is they just go up and they get their paperwork or what they're going to say, and they say that the investigative journalism is suffering. And it's only really the alternative media that's putting the information out there.
Yeah, it's only the internet. If it wasn't for the internet, we'd still be as you know, dumbed down as we were before. And I mean, the fact is there are six major companies that control all of the world's media, or the vast majority of the world's media. And those six companies are all owned and controlled by pretty much the same people. Right. So we should be very scared, you know. We should be very afraid of what is. And similarly, actually, they are probably afraid of the internet, because, you know, that is one place where you can still get the truth. But they're doing everything they can to A, muddy the waters by posting lots of nonsense, and B, control what goes out on the internet and censor. What goes on the internet.
So, I agree. I think the alternative media itself has been infiltrated, just like everything else in the past has been infiltrated. You know, there's some. I'm very interested in hearing if there is any guests you've had on that really hit you with the wow factor?
Lots and lots of those guests, you know, people like David Icke and people like Cynthia McKinney, you know, who was a former congresswoman in the U.S., who has been on two efforts to break the blockade of Gaza. You know, one time Israeli Defense Forces tried to sink her boat in international waters by ramming it. Another time she was arrested and thrown in jail in Israel. And the American government did nothing to get her out. This is a former congresswoman.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, I'm sorry, America, whose side are you on?
Well, maybe she was swimming in a pool they didn't want her swimming in.
Well, I'm sure that's the case.
Yeah, you know.
She's a congresswoman. Yeah, well, she's an extraordinary woman. You should have her on your show,
Scott. I absolutely will.
Cynthia McKinney. She is the bravest woman, the bravest woman I have ever met in my life, and I'm in awe of her. You know, she really is something special.
Mm. And anybody else who's hit you right on the chin like that?
Oh, I don't know, so many. It's, you know, you're putting me on the spot here. People like Brian Gerrish, he's a really interesting man who has a newspaper that he runs, and he speaks a lot. The newspaper is called UK Column, mm-hmm. and he speaks about the subversive influence of a so-called charity called Common Purpose and the way the child courts in the UK are operating. I'm just looking through a list of people.
How about Thomas Sheridan?
Thomas Sheridan, well, he was my first guest on my new show, One Step Beyond. And he's written a book called Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath, about psychopaths. And, you know, yes, several people have written about psychopathy recently and shown that something like 4% of the world is psychopathic, or certainly males, maybe small percentage of females. And these people are the people who have no conscience, they have no empathy, and they're therefore more capable of climbing to the top of the greasy pole. Yeah,
I was going to say, they're psychopaths, also known as religious leaders, politicians, and lawyers.
Yeah, well, they will do whatever is necessary without any fear of you know, moral damage to themselves. You know, I'm sure they could quite easily kill somebody, for instance, and then go and have tea with their mother, and their mother would not know that they just killed somebody. Whereas if somebody who wasn't a psychopath were to do that, I think they would give lots of signals out that they're, you know, they're concerned and they're disturbed. But these people, and if you look at the behavior of certain people in power, it is fairly obvious these people have psychopathic tendencies and are psychopaths.
Yeah.
You know, because they have no conscience. I mean, you have people like Tony Blair's a great example, the former leader of the British Parliament. Tony Blair professes to be a Christian and converted to Catholicism, and presumably so that he could end up as president of Europe, which didn't happen, unfortunately for him. But this is a man who professes to be a Christian, and yet he ordered the bombing of women and children in Bosnia on Christmas Day. There's Happy Christmas from Tony Blair. You know, is this a psychopathic action? Well, yes, I think it probably is.
Yeah.
You know, and
it amazes me and other people that these sorts of things can be done. That, you know, normal people, I've talked about this on the show, normal people who would meet each other on the street and say, hey, how you doing, you know, they wouldn't do these sorts of things. Their conscience would prevent these actions from happening.
Yeah.
And well, yet, at that level, they can do those things that affect masses of people with no reflection.
That's right, absolutely. Well, there's no comeback for them because they feel nothing, so it doesn't matter. But, I mean, the point that Thomas Sheridan makes, which I think is actually a very wise point, and that is that he thinks that for the evolution of mankind, we might actually need psychopaths so that we can recognize the truth in ourselves.
Oh, okay.
And they're kind of there as an educational element of mankind. You know, there's no way we can get rid of them. They are there. And I think, you know, publicizing them, find so that people recognize them, mm-hmm. is the way of controlling them. You know, because once you know that these people are psychopaths, people at the top of corporations behave psychopathically. Most corporations do behave psychopathically.
Right.
They do things to shaft their competitors, for instance, and rip off their customers, which are psychopathic.
Mm. That's when the term "it's just business" comes
from. Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Mm. And if you look at big corporations and what they do, you will see that the vast majority of big corporations are just like that.
Yeah, they'll do those sorts of things all in the name of business. It's just business, yeah. Buddy. Don't take it personally. It's just business, you know.
That's right. And they think anybody who has empathy for the harm that they cause, for the people who they harm, are weak. They think those people are weak, and they laugh at those people.
Yeah, they're all the way to the bank.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and of course, they recognize each other, so they get promoted. And they, you know, they build a cohort of people mm-hmm. in control, in power.
Pyramidal structure, almost.
Yeah, they don't want normal people to have any power.
Yeah, you've got to be able to make the hard decisions. You've got to be able to, you know, act like a shark. You know, you have to be able to, all of those things that are lauded as good qualities at higher levels of government and in heads of corporations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is no doubt that there is enough of everything on this planet for 7 billion people and more. Enough of everything for everybody to have a great life. And the vast majority of people on this planet are having, can I use rude words on this show?
Oh, you use any rude word you like.
Okay, well, they're having a shit life, you know, and they're having a shit life because of the psychopaths.
I completely agree.
And the psychopaths want to reduce the number of useless eaters, as they call those people, with nothing. Mm-hmm. Not to sucker them and maintain them and sustain them, but to destroy them so that there are not 7 billion people that might rise up against them, but... You know, as it says on the Georgia Guidestones, 500 million people.
I was going to say, not only that, they actually carve it in stone in multiple languages so that everybody knows that they don't care that you know.
Well, it seems to be part of the methodology by which they work, that they have to do it in the open. So they have to tell us what they're doing. And they use all kinds of symbolism, and they use all kinds of, public acts like 9/11 to kind of tell us, and that gives them a way of claiming that they told us, and therefore we accept it.
Well,
not doing anything about it.
Well, let's talk about that. You've had many guests on your show. Which is brilliant, by the way. I would highly recommend anybody that wants to see a great TV show. I'm not a big fan of TV. Got rid of mine 18 years ago. But this show is worth having a TV for. I'm telling you that right now. I love your show. I think it's great.
Thank you. It's very kind of you.
You've had many guests on your show talking about the 9/11 conspiracy, the 9/11 situation. Now, having said that, what's your opinion? Do you think it was an inside job, or do you think the guys that say it was an inside job are just sort of crazy?
Well, okay, let's look at what happened then, shall we? 19 ill-trained Arabs, some of whom allegedly are still alive, and a guy in a cave in Afghanistan were able to shut down the most sophisticated air defense system in the world for the hours necessary that none of the planes were shot down. Three tower blocks, the World Trade Centers 1 and 2, which are 110 stories, and World Trade Center 7, which is 46 stories, collapsed at nearly free fall speed into their own footprints as a result of fire. Which has never happened to a steel frame building anywhere else in the world. And of course, Building 7, 47 stories, would have made it the tallest building in virtually every state in America, wasn't hit by a plane. So That seems strange, to say the least. And then the 757 that hit the Pentagon with a wingspan of, what, 120 foot or something, and two engines hanging off those wings that were about 12 foot in diameter. The entire aeroplane, including the tailplane, which was 60 foot tall, disappeared into a 16-foot round hole in the face of the Pentagon before the wall collapsed, before it collapsed. So there's pictures of that. So how on earth does a 757 fit inside a 16-foot round hole and then vaporize? So there are no parts left, no black boxes. And then how does the American government genetically test all the corpses, which don't get vaporized, so they know who they are? Okay. How does another plane, a 767, I believe, hit a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, making a small hole with nothing in it? No seats, no engines, no wings, no drinks trolleys, no passengers, no blood. There'd be hundreds of gallons of blood. There's nothing in the hole. Nothing. So how is that possible? Is the official story full of holes? Yes, it is. Yeah, it's a crock of shit.
Yeah, okay. Well, I figured that was going to be your answer, because I think anybody that looks at 9/11, and there are many theories as to what exactly happened, and I've heard a lot of them, and I don't really know which theory to choose, but that's besides the point. Beside the point, meaning I think that it was absolutely an inside job.
Yeah, I mean,
I can go that far.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm the same. I don't know how it was done, because I've also interviewed lots of people. I interviewed William Lewis, who produced and directed 9/11 in Plain Sight, for instance. I also interviewed Dr. Judy Wood, who wrote a book, Where the Towers Go, who talks about directed energy weapons.
Right.
But I don't know whether thermite or thermate or nanothermite or directed energy weapons or anything. I don't know what was used. All I do know is the planes hitting buildings. That, by the way, both of the twin towers were designed to be hit by planes.
Yes,
the biggest planes in the world at that time, 737s, which are virtually as big as the 767s that did hit them, and withstand the, you know, have a lot of redundancy built in to withstand those airstrikes. So, you know, how did they come down? I don't know. I honestly don't know. But I do know they didn't come down according to the 9/11 Commission report.
Or the official statements, yeah.
Well, the official statement that never even addressed what happened to Building 7. And you can go online at 5:20 in the afternoon of 9/11. It fell down at freefall speed into its own footprint. And you can see that those pictures, the films, several films online right now if you care to look. And how is that possible? You know, buildings, steel frame buildings all over the world have burnt for days because of fires in them. And when the fires are eventually put out or subside because they've eaten up all the fuel, the buildings are still standing because they're made of steel. Steel doesn't melt. Kerosene doesn't melt, doesn't burn hot enough, especially not in an open fire, to even soften steel. Not at all. Impossible. Absolutely impossible. So how does this happen? How do these buildings, you know, just assume for a moment that it burned hot enough on one or two or three floors to soften the steel. What you would have had is a collapse of the towers above, the floors above, onto the ones below, and that would, then it would have stopped.
Right.
It wouldn't have kept going.
Right, right.
It defies Newton's laws of motion, that every force has an equal and opposite reaction.
Right.
It cannot happen. You know, it cannot happen. Lots and lots of engineers and architects and pilots have joined organizations to say it can't have happened like that.
Yeah, yeah, they're saying that there's something wrong. I have a few favorites in that, and one of them was the passport, the magical passport.
That fluttered down out of the fireball into Manhattan.
The indestructible.
You know, Hanny Hanjour, or one of them, wasn't it? It wasn't Hanny Hanjour. He was the Pentagon guy. But, yeah, I mean, just, you know, how stupid do they really think we are? Yeah.
Made of titanium, obviously.
Well, no, actually, I'm sorry. It can't have been made of titanium because the engines of the airplanes were made of titanium, and they vaporized.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, can't. Maybe there's a metal that alien metal. Maybe it's magic metal from the
alien. Magic metal as used by terrorists to forge their passports.
Yeah, there's a couple of them, you know. When, what was his name, Silverstein said, we said...
Oh, Larry Silverstein, the leaseholder or the owner of the...
Such a terrible loss of life. I told them to pull it. And then later on tried to explain that pull it meant get, you know, make sure that the firefighters out of the way. And
but they were already out at that time. At the time he's supposed to have said pull it, they were already out of the building and had been out of it for a very long time.
Right. And pulling it is a well-known term in demolition, to pull a building, to demolish.
And you couldn't have put the charges in that building on the day. That would have been impossible.
Yeah. Hurry up, guys. It's a burning building that's just about to fall down of its own free will. Let's all get in there and put some explosive charges in. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
There's so much that doesn't make any sense. I mean, we can flip over to a whole bunch of different areas. But I wanted to ask you, we've covered 9/11, and I think we both agreed 9/11 was something very unusual, and the official story just doesn't wash in any way, shape, or form. But I don't know if we'll ever see an investigation. God, by the time the next day happened, they had how many truckloads? 8 truckloads, you know, taken out of there of the evidence?
Yeah, well, they destroyed the evidence, of course. They didn't want that being, you know, that was a crime in itself. You know, it was a crime scene, and the evidence should have been protected. But it wasn't.
No, it wasn't.
So, you know, but you know, what, I've also done shows about what happened on 7/7 in London.
Right, exactly. 7/7. You know, that's the English version of 9/11.
The English version of 9/11 that happened at the time that the G8 nations were meeting in Scotland, Tony Blair and George W. Bush and so on.
Just a coincidence.
Just absolutely a coincidence, you know. And Netanyahu was in London at the time and warned not to go into central London. Somehow Mossad seemed to know about it in advance. I've interviewed Daniel Obuchiki, who's a survivor of the bus bomb in Tavistock Square. He was actually on that bus, and his version of events is very different from the... Well, there isn't really an official version. There's a dialogue, but there's been no investigation as such into it. There's been no inquiry into it.
What did he say?
Well, he says that, you know, he doesn't understand how all these bodies were supposed to have been on the bus because they weren't there, you know. And the mystery man with the backpack that's supposed to have set off the thing wasn't there. He's written a book. He's written a book called The Fourth Bomb, I think it's called.
Okay.
Which I recommend people read, you know, because it tells a very different version, and I think people ought to know about that different version and make their own mind up.
And he was there, so he
was. He was on the bus. No one in officialdom has said he's a liar, you know. I'm absolutely convinced that he spoke the truth about his experience of being on the bus. Whether you believe what he said about that experience, that's up to you, of course.
Right, of course.
I think there's a very good chance that, you know, as an eyewitness, his version of events is likely to be truthful. Why would he put himself in kind of danger by coming up, making stuff up? What's he got to gain?
Right, exactly. Well, there are people that have come out talking about 9/11 that have died mysteriously of heart attacks, and I think his last name was Jennings, if I remember correctly.
Well, there's also that guy Rodriguez, who was like the caretaker.
Right.
Who said the explosions were going off in the basement, in the sub-basements of the Twin Towers, and he mysteriously died. So, you know, yeah, they don't want the truth to come out because it puts them at risk, I suppose. Oh, another person I interviewed about 7/7 was a chap called Dr. Nicholas Kollerstrom. That's Kollerstrom, who wrote a book called Terror on the Tube. And he's investigated it forensically, you know, for instance, in the official narrative, the four people carrying the bombs are supposed to have got on a train in Luton, which is about 35 miles outside London, and come down to London and then go on to the different underground railway lines and set off their bombs exactly at the same time, which is quite extraordinary.
Really?
Yeah, except that the train they're supposed to have been on in the official narrative didn't run that day. And the next one would have made it too late for them to have caught the connections. You know, so now he's revealed this, and they've, you know, the official narrative has been kind of edited a bit to try and pretend they got a much earlier train.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing how that happens. Official testimony gets edited.
But there's no film. You know, none of the cameras in any of the stations, of which there are thousands, recorded them. You know, they show film on television of them. But this is on a so-called recce trip, a reconnaissance trip, a couple of weeks before.
Right.
And I think it's fairly obvious that they were patsies, and they were trying to help some, you know, by playing Muslim hijackers or terrorists in a security exercise. They were trying to help out, if you like, and they were set up as patsies. I think that's probably the truth of the matter. Mm. So, we've never had an inquiry.
Yeah, that's a shame. I was going to ask you, this is fascinating, but I was going to ask you, have you yourself, personally, now you talk about UFOs and all kinds of great things on your show, but have you of yourself, personally, ever seen, had a weird event happen to you, an unusual occurrence? Have you ever seen a ghost? Have you ever seen a UFO yourself?
No, I've never seen a ghost. I've never seen a UFO. No, I haven't had those kind of experiences. And, you know, I don't know why. Should I have? I don't know.
Well, with all the work you're putting in, I think you're due.
Well, it would be nice, you know. But, I'm the kind of guy that I'd like it to land in my back garden and a little ramp to open up and some guys to come out and say, hey, Theo, fancy a trip around the universe? And I'd probably go, yeah, sure, let me just grab a camera.
Yeah, and a videotape, high definition.
That's right, and I'll come with you. You know, that would be cool, but, you know, you see stuff in the sky. I mean, unidentified flying objects are unidentified. So, you know, I don't know. Are they aliens? Are they people from another dimension? You know, it's like, it seems the more and more, we spoke about this when we spoke prior to doing this recording, it seems more and more of the things that you look at are the truth, if you like, is just around the corner. You know, it's just out of sight, you know. It's so close that you can almost taste it, you can almost touch it, you can almost smell it, but you can't, you know. You've got things like the Disclosure Project, you know, hundreds of people with lots to lose by coming out in public and saying, I saw this, I saw that, I had these experiences and so on. But there's never any conclusive proof. No one has ever come forward and said, look, here's a piece of a UFO, analyze it. Mm. Have they? Not convincingly.
No.
You know? And then, of course, there's loads of, as we said before, you know, there's loads of stuff on the internet, like people can do fake films. And of course, now that they can do it really cheaply and easily, there are thousands of fake films which look fabulous, but they're fake.
Yeah.
So what's the point? Yeah.
Well, I mean, with the 3D studio now and all of this stuff, I mean, I was in the UFO field 25 years ago, and when we got, you know, the VHS tapes or stuff like that, they were very interesting, but not too many people had the skills back then that they do now. Or if they did, then the people that were giving us, which is a guy who lived out in the bush, just bought a brand new fangled recorder and, you know, seen a light over the trees and told his son to run in and get that new fangled recorder he just bought, brought it out, took a video of it, brought it in, handed it to us and said, here, I was told this is what you guys do, so have a look at that and tell me what it is.
Yeah.
You know, just a normal guy. But yeah, I mean, nowadays the stuff you're seeing on the, you know, and of course we used to do soil samples and stuff like that for landing patch areas and you know, take it to labs and all kinds of fun stuff like that, which is physical evidence. Generally,
it's never conclusive, is it? It's never undeniable physical evidence. Here at last is the proof. Here at last is a sentient alien who's going to come on my show and talk to people. And I guarantee if I did have a sentient alien on my show, everyone would be texting in going, he's a bloke in a suit, yeah. You know, or he's, you know, CGI or whatever he is, you know. He's a freak.
Yeah.
I've interviewed Lloyd Pye. Now, Lloyd Pye has got this Star Child skull, as I'm sure you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he brought that on the show.
I've been for 20 years.
Yeah, well, he's a fabulous guy. And he wrote a fantastic book also called Everything You Know Is Wrong, which is...
And he's written an update to that called The Intervention Theory, which is a e-book that you can get off his site.
Okay, well, I haven't read that one, but I have read quite a lot of his other stuff. So, you know, he has got some kind of evidence. But again, it's, you know, and they have investigated this Star Child skull's matrilineal DNA. The mother's DNA is human, but the father's DNA seems to not be human.
Well, that's changed.
You know.
Now, so, they're saying it may be both.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe just around that corner is that evidence, and we can all go, oh, well, fantastic at last, you know. But maybe we can't. Maybe we still can't. But that seems to be about the closest, you know. And, I mean, there are lots of strange skulls in lots of parts of the world, which don't seem to be entirely
human. You mean the long skull ones?
Yeah, those long skulls that they have in places like Chile and Peru, you know. Mm-hmm.
They are weird, aren't they?
They don't
really fit the... because there was a process in early history where they did what was called binding, and they would bind their head and elongate it.
They would put a board, they'd strap a board to the back of their head.
Yeah.
But then you'd have a flat skull, and lots of those skulls are not flat at the back. And not only, you know, maybe they were bound, but how come the volume...
It was so much bigger
than a normal skull. Because all you're doing with binding is changing the shape.
You're not changing the volume.
And the sutures are different as well on some of those skulls. You know, humans have a certain number of sutures on our heads where the sort of panels, that's right, where the panels meet. And, you know, little babies have got two soft spots on the top of their heads. And these skulls seem to be different. They have a different number of sutures. So... binding does not explain them.
Oh, no, absolutely not. They're really weird.
But again, is that proof? You know, what is it telling us? We don't really know.
Yeah, well, getting the DNA for doing a test on that has become politically very difficult. I know that there's some people that are trying, because some of those skulls even have hair tufts on them.
They do. You're red hair, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, if they could get a sample, but, of course, the museums that have them won't let them out.
No.
Well, they'll say, no. But I just need to take a piece. Look, it's hair. It's like DNA. There's a lot they could do with that, but they're having a great deal of difficulty convincing them to do it. I know people like Klaus Donner and Michael Cremo are working towards that end, as well as Lloyd Pye. Because
I've got Michael Cremo coming on my show this summer, actually.
Oh, that'll be awesome. Yeah, I love Michael. He's really put a lot out there doing his...
doing archaeology and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. What great stuff he's been doing with Forbidden Archaeology. And of course, Lloyd Pye is in sort of the same range of what he's doing, as well as Klaus Donner. You should definitely have him on your show. Klaus Donner's brilliant.
Yeah, we spoke about him, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Okay, well, so you've never had a UFO experience, you've never seen a ghost, you've never been abducted.
No, I know lots of people who have, apparently, you know, including, you know, some who don't want to tell anybody about it. They won't go on my show, for instance, and say they've been abducted, but they believe absolutely that they have been.
Mm.
They've been experimented on and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, of course, I don't know if it's true. Mm. You know, some bit on my show have said it, you know, but I just don't know.
Well, I've asked you one end of the spectrum. If you've had guests on your show that have really, you know, changed your worldview, have you had others, and you don't have to mention names, but have you had others on your show that made you think, oh, please, God, make it stop?
What, you mean that I thought were full of shit?
Yeah.
Do you know, not really. No, I'm, you know, because I feel that I'm an outlet for views that aren't acceptable on mainstream media, and therefore it's not for me to start tearing into them and calling them, you know, saying that they're wrong. I'll let them have a voice, and if they say things that I think are indefensible or deserve to be explained, I will ask them to explain it. But I, honestly, there's only been one person, I think, that I've ever interviewed who I thought was a waste of time. And it wasn't somebody that I found as a guest myself. It was kind of found for me, and I won't name the person.
But
funnily enough, he's extraordinarily proud of his, you know, hour or 2 hours in the sun, and posted it everywhere, you know.
Yeah, the one interview where you're screaming, please, God, make it stop, and it's all over the internet, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So what can you do? I mean, you know, I feel I have a kind of obligation to try and be the devil's advocate, you know, and not just mock, because there are plenty of television programs on mainstream television in the UK.
Absolutely.
Where they will occasionally have some of these so-called conspiracy theorists or whatever on, and they treat them like nutters. You know, they treat them like raving lunatics who are in dire need of medication.
Right, yeah. And they have a lineup of debunkers on the other side of the table, right?
Yeah, absolutely, just tearing strips off them. But it's, you know, it's not good television. I don't think, I mean, they seem to think that it is, but it's, you know, it doesn't actually serve humanity in any way. Let's hear these voices. Let's hear what people have got to say. Maybe we can learn something. I think we can probably learn something from everybody.
Yeah, UFOs are, I think, as far as just the topic of UFOs, are becoming more mainstream as time goes by. I think it's lessening the amount of skeptics that are on the other end of the table. It used to be four debunkers to one, you know, pro-UFO guy. Now it's maybe, you know, one-on-one. I think it's lessening, and I think look at all the movies that are out nowadays, you know, on UFOs. Look at all the TV shows, Ancient Aliens and, you know, UFO Files and all of those, you know.
Yeah, the Discovery Channel is full of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. A lot of people do believe it. Whether, you know, I don't know, where's it leading to? Where's it, you know, where is that all going? Is there going to be some kind of denouement? Is there going to be some kind of exposure finally?
Well,
you know, is the U.S. government going to say, "Yeah, we got some UFOs at Roswell, from Roswell, you know, buried in a mountain somewhere, like in the film Independence
Day"? Yeah,
you know,
well,
maybe
I've spoken to people that feel that is possible. That someday, that if they're pressured enough, the government will come out and say, "Okay, guys, we know about UFOs. We've been tracking them since 1946, you know, and we wanted to tell you all this information." I personally, myself, don't think that that will happen, because I think that there's too many questions that come up from that admission.
Well, that's the problem. The longer they keep things secret, the harder it is to reveal it. Except, you know, if people have passed on and then they can kind of say, because conspiracy theories of, you know, 50 years ago, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which got the United States into the war in Vietnam,
right,
are now in the public domain. So now it's okay to talk about those things, and they accept that it actually didn't happen. You know, America conned its way into the war in Vietnam, just as, you know, it's now in the public domain that Pearl Harbor was notified to the American. They knew it was going to happen, and they moved their choicest battleships out of Pearl Harbor before the attack.
Right.
They knew it was going to happen, but they wanted a reason to join the war on behalf of, you know, in alliance with the British, for instance.
And it filled up the ranks of outraged patriots. Right.
That's how they got it to happen, because America didn't want to go to war. The American people didn't want to join the Second World War. And just as they joined the First World War, exactly the same thing happened, the sinking of the Lusitania. You know, it was the German government posted advertisements in the mainstream media in New York, like half-page adverts saying, "Do not go on the Lusitania because it will be sunk." And the reason was because the owners of the Lusitania had said that they were carrying arms.
Yeah.
For the Allies. Now, why would they do this? Why would they publicly do this? It was just bait. It was like a Trojan horse. And it's quite likely, actually, that the Germans didn't attack it, that it was us. You know, it was the English that did it, that sent the Lusitania. because we wanted America on side in the First World War, and more or less the same thing happened in for the Second World War.
And this is a repeating cycle, it seems.
Yeah, so yeah, eventually, they tell us, eventually, when it doesn't matter anymore, no one can go to prison anymore.
Right.
You know, so 9/11 was, you know, like the Project for New American Century said, that short of another Pearl Harbor, we won't be able to invade Iraq or Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, yeah.
And then we had a new Pearl Harbor, and then we did invade Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You know, 11 years of war in Afghanistan. Well, what the hell are we there for?
Who knows? There's a lot of money.
Well, there's the opium trade. You know, there's the opium, and there's the pipeline from the north, from the gas pipeline, which had to be built and protected. So that's why they're there. And, of course, also they've discovered in Afghanistan massive mineral deposits, very valuable mineral deposits. So there are three reasons to be there. So it's nothing to do with some, you know, bin Laden bloke in a cave. That's that's nonsense.
I would add a fourth reason. There is a great deal of money to be made in war.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Of course there's a great deal of money to be made in war. And the industrial military complex needs to keep wars going. You know, so 11 years, it's pretty good going.
Right. And you need to be in these other countries so that you can funnel money out of them for the black op programs.
Like the Iran-Contra affair, you know.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of money needed to be, I mean, you don't think that, you know, we should still be using combustible engines. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah, you're very into this free energy stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, when Wilbur Wright and his brother were making the first plane, which we look into it, there was other people doing the work previous to them, but that's besides the case. The scientists wouldn't come watch because they knew that lighter-than-air travel was impossible. Therefore, they don't have to go watch it happen.
Yeah, you mean heavier-than-air travel. Hot air balloons were lighter-than-air, and they worked a long time ago, you know, the 16th century. But, yeah, I mean, their first flight was no longer than the wingspan of the current Airbus A380, you know, the double-decker one.
Right.
Bigger than the jumbo, which is extraordinary, isn't it? And within 10 years, we were flying all over the world.
Yeah.
Which is quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're right, of course. I mean, maybe things are kept secret. You know, like there's been rumors for very many years that the oil companies buy the patents and suppress them in things that would threaten their
Absolutely.
Business.
We've had multiple guests on that have, you know, talked about this sort of thing that have actually who are inventors. They're actual inventors who have made these things have been suppressed. They've had things stolen from them. Their labs have been leaked out. They've been had false charges brought up against them, all kinds of these. But these are things that are just standard operating procedure, and it doesn't just apply to free energy. It applies to anything in your health care that will cure or fix anything, because the pharmaceutical industry doesn't want you to cure the thing. It wants to treat the symptoms. Now, you can
wants you to be dependent on the drugs, of course it does.
Right. So if you can believe that that's the case with the pharmaceutical industry, it's not that far of a leap to go into the technical industry and realize that the same modus operandi has been affecting that area for decades and decades. This is, you know, normal stuff. If Royal Rife actually did what, you know, the reports of his technology did, then that would be not something that the pharmaceutical industry and Big Pharma would be interested in.
Yeah, well, except to suppress it. No, you're right. Royal Raymond Rife, yeah, he was the optical engineer that invented optical microscopes that were able to look at live viruses, and therefore he could work out the frequencies of the pulses that would destroy them.
Right.
Yeah, and of course his work was suppressed. But, you know, it's not quite the same as free energy, though, is it, Scott? I know you're really keen on that, but free energy is a bit like that other stuff. You know, it's just around the corner, isn't it? It's always just around the corner. If somebody comes to me and says, here's a free energy device, you know, plug it in the mains, disconnect the mains and run your house on it, I'd go, thank you very much, I'd like one.
Yes.
But it never happens.
Somebody said, here's a cure to cancer, just just take this and it'll wipe out your cancer. I'd like one of those too. But I don't think the pharmaceutical industry is going to allow that to happen.
No, well, I've done lots of shows on health matters, you know, all kinds of things. We have to be really careful about cancer cures in the UK. There's even a Cancer Act which prohibits anyone making any claims about being able to cure cancer, believe it or not.
You're not allowed to say the word cure.
No, absolutely not. And there's also Ofcom rules. Ofcom controls what goes out on television. And you can't say lots of stuff. You can't, you can't allow people to make certain claims.
Right.
So it's very, very difficult. But I've done also shows about, medicine and so on. I mean, I've interviewed a guy called Trevor Gunn twice on different shows, who's a vaccines expert. And if you look at the vaccines, the history of vaccines, if you look at the graphs that the vaccine industry, the big pharma uses to explain how effective their vaccines are, they'll show you a falling line, and at the top of that line will be the introduction of a vaccine.
Right.
And you think, wow, look at that. There used to be this many people dying of this disease every year, and now there are hardly any. Isn't that effective? But if you take the same data from the same source, for instance, in the UK, the Office of National Statistics, which is a government agency, and take it back another 50 years or 100 years, you'll see that that line has been falling like a stone long before the vaccines were introduced. And the reason for that is because of hygiene, sewers.
Sanitation, yeah.
Sanitation. And nothing to do with the vaccine at all. The line doesn't alter when the vaccines are introduced. And for instance, there is one perfect example of this. 100 years ago, one of the biggest killers, killer diseases in the UK was something called scarlet fever. I don't know whether you've heard of scarlet fever.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have never heard of anybody contracting scarlet fever or anybody, I've never read it in the newspaper of anyone having scarlet fever or anyone dying of scarlet fever. Scarlet fever effectively doesn't exist anymore. Is it because there's a vaccine? No, there's no vaccine for scarlet fever. And yet that, like those, all those other diseases for which there are vaccines, has disappeared, absolutely disappeared, certainly in the West where there's proper sanitation. So that's the perfect example. You know, we're being conned, and the stuff that's in vaccines, things like neurotoxins, like mercury.
Thimerosal, yeah.
Yeah, thimerosal, which is mercury, and aluminium, or aluminum, as you say, which is a neurotoxin, and things that are found in the body, like squalene, which is a fat that's found in the body, but it's not injected into your blood. It's not in your blood, and your brain is made out of squalene. If your body recognizes this is an alien invader, it will start attacking it. And it will start attacking your own body. So all these autoimmune diseases that people are suffering from could be put down to the stuff that's in the vaccines that they're given.
Exactly.
It's extremely worrying, you know. And there are plenty of places in the world where the vaccines are mandatory for children.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, It's a worry, isn't it? We're giving our children, knowingly giving our children neurotoxins, massively powerful neurotoxins. And depending on how lucky you are, whether they've shaken the bottle before they take your dose out, you could be getting a massive, massive amount of it. But any amount is dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that the amount of vaccines over the decades has increased exponentially.
Yeah.
The point where you're taking so many, you're giving a young child the same dose you would, a 220-pound man.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
in multiple doses at the same time very early on in their lives, often before they're able to make things like bile, which can help you find some of this stuff.
And the interesting connection with the increase in autism over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you're not allowed to say that anymore because, the people who did say that and they had studies that prove that have been vilified and, lost their jobs over it. Just the same with GMO, genetically modified foods.
Yeah.
You know, they've lost their jobs and been vilified over it.
Yeah, you mean the GMOs, the Terminator seeds. I mean, how crazy is that? Terminator seeds. What the craziest thing I've ever heard. Farmers have been saving their seeds for generations
And they come up with, Monsanto comes up with the Terminator seed that you can only use once. That's crazy.
Or a seed that you can only utilize if you're prepared to coat it in a really dangerous
pesticide.
Pesticide, yeah. Roundup.
Yeah, that's Roundup. Wow. Yeah, tell me about it. That's some crazy stuff. It just seems to me that we're going back to the psychopath thing again here. Because this is psychopathic stuff. This is craziness. The world is upside down. And in so many of these areas, the world is upside down that it's really strange.
Yeah. Odd. It is really sad, and it is why I do what I do, why I have to do these shows, because someone's got to speak out. Someone's got to say, let's hear the other side of the story. Let's hear what proper experts, in most cases I'm interviewing people who are scientists or experts on these subjects. And I'm speaking truth to power, because the mainstream media has abrogated all responsibility and will just blindly trot out the lies that they're told because somebody else has another agenda, or some other people have other agendas.
I'm curious, covering the subjects you cover, have you ever had any incidents where you've been, threatened, or has any weird things happened to your show previous? You ever had guests call and say, I can't come on because I've been threatened, or...
No, isn't this bizarre? You'd think, wouldn't you, that would be the case, but actually not. No, not really. The only thing that's even been close to that is I once had a very large helicopter hovering over the studio while I was on air, because my show is live, and it was a very big, ugly helicopter hovering over the studio for quite a while, making a lot of noise, but... That could just be coincidence, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that could just be an exercise, or it could be, it could be a medical helicopter.
Yeah, otherwise, no, honestly not, no. And it's like, isn't that weird? You'd think, wouldn't you, oh, they're going to get at me and blah, 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 blah. But, as I say, I try and be the devil's advocate. I don't have an opinion. When I'm interviewing these people, I don't have an opinion. I simply ask them questions. And if they say things which need backing up or... explication or whatever, I will ask more questions until they explain what it is they said. So, in that sense, I'm kind of like a journalist. But I'm one who's prepared to listen to things that perhaps other journalists would instantly say, well, that's rubbish. That's not the mainstream thought, and you can't say it. But I haven't been threatened. No.
Okay. Have you ever had anybody on your show talking about something like a secret space program? Bases on the moon.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Quite a few people talking about bases on the moon, bases on Mars, because there is quite a lot of picture evidence from Mars and the moon of all kinds of stuff on there. Yeah, so I have, I've interviewed quite a few people on those kind of subjects about stuff like that, and also about the moon landings, whether they were... Mm-hmm. Whether they really happened, which I think is a subject I'm particularly interested in, actually. And there are plenty of websites you can go to that show you how the pictures, the picture evidence for the Apollo program is very clearly faked. I have no hesitation in saying that. Whether they went or not, I honestly don't know, because I wasn't there and I didn't see them. But I do know that the picture evidence is faked. You cannot have, for instance, a lunar rover on the moon's surface some way from the lunar expeditionary module, the thing that lands, with no tracks in the dust between the wheels and going away from the wheels. How did it get there? Even though there are footprints underneath it and all around it, there are no tire tracks. How did that happen? Well, it was lowered by crane, obviously, onto the set. Yeah. And there's plenty of evidence for that. Just that alone is enough to tell you that they were fake.
There was something going on there.
But there was plenty of other evidence that they're fake.
There's a lot of weird pictures on of things on the moon, like just odd shapes that look, I don't know.
Oh, it's like the domes and the spires and all this, Well, maybe. But I don't think they're necessarily in the Apollo record. I think the Apollo record is shot on Earth. And anything that's in the background that's weird, you know, where it's been blacked out, blocked out in black or whatever, covered up lights or something, you know, that's because it's shot in a studio or in, you know, the desert somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
There are pictures from orbit of Mars and the Moon, which suggest there may be other things there. Yeah, absolutely, particularly on Mars.
So why don't you think there was a program beyond, why aren't we going to the Moon now?
I don't think we ever went. You know, I think that it's likely that we never went because of all the problems in going.
The radiation.
lots of problems. Well, radiation is one of them. You know, cooling, the place, the life support system they wore, they were on expeditions that lasted 4 or 5 hours. And all they had in them to cool you down, this is in unbelievable direct sunlight and reflected from behind you. It wasn't like one half of you was hot and one half of you was cold because the ground would reflect the light back at you on the other side. And all they had in terms of the ability to cool you down was about 4 pints of water, which was supposed to provide your drinking water and your coolant. And it just doesn't make sense. You just can't do it. You can't go on these expeditions on the Moon. So, you know, I think probably we didn't go, and it was, it was a big bluff. And the money that NASA was extracting from the American government was used on other things, on
black projects.
Yeah, black projects, military satellites, you know, search and kill satellites and things like that, you know.
I wonder why we're not going now, if we would have the technology now to go.
Well, you know, absolutely. And a shuttle which has been cancelled was far less powerful than supposedly the Saturn V in terms of its payload. How could they dump the Saturn V, which was apparently so bloody successful, and replace it with something that comparatively was not even in the same ballpark? How could that happen? And now that's been dumped. They've got nothing. I mean, they've got some, what's that, the rocket? They've got a tiny rocket, haven't they? The Centaur, is it? Or the Atlas? The Atlas, I think.
Okay.
That still goes into space. But that's about it. It's pathetic, you know. And they're relying on the Russians.
Yeah, it's like no space grant program.
Yeah, no space. We can't get men into space, or the Americans can't get men into space anymore.
No. Well, then the Chinese are setting up a launch.
Space station,
They're
building a space station. They've sent cameras around the Moon, and so have the Japanese. And so, by the way, Iran has sent missiles into space.
there you go. I mean, there's a lot of technology going on. It's just, it seems to me they're going backwards, but at least to the public persona.
Because they never did it. That's why they're going backwards, because they never did it. It was just a scam. You know, the other thing is that the American government wanted to take the people's mind off the fact that there was a massive war going on in Southeast Asia in which hundreds, thousands of Americans were being killed. And that was Vietnam. So, right. You know, sending a man to the Moon, or several men, you know, was probably a good PR exercise, just like Apollo 13 was, you know, because people had got bored. By the time Apollo 12 went, people were bored already.
Yeah, it's been there, done that, yeah.
Yeah, so they had to spice it up by having one that exploded. The problem, of course, once again, is that just like the collapse of the World Trade Center, that it confounded Newton's laws of motion, that every force has an equal and opposite reaction, and therefore if an explosion happens in your spaceship, blowing panels off the spaceship and forcing you to abandon that part of it, you would be thrust at great speed in the opposite direction, i.e. not to the Moon anymore, going elsewhere. So how did Apollo 13 hit orbit around the Moon so successfully and bounce back again and come back to Earth? It couldn't have. It just couldn't have. And, you know, no one has ever explained that.
Right. Yeah, those are questions that make you go,
Exactly.
And there's a lot to the space program that does seem a little odd, that doesn't make really any sense. I know that you've interviewed a lot of people about 2012, and specifically the date, December 21st, 2012, and some of your guests have talked about that.
Yeah, people like Adrian Gilbert and Michael Tesarian and Jeff Stray and Freeman, who's a guy that is in Texas, and Andy Lloyd and people like that. Yeah, a lot of people have written about it or studied the subject, and It is interesting that lots of calendars, not just the ones from South America, seem to kind of end on that day. But the consensus from most of the people I've interviewed, and I think the sort of consensus that I tend to accept, is that there may be big changes. You know, things like the poles may shift. You know, okay. North becomes south, and so on. And we might cross some sort of line in the heavens. You know, so we become northern hemisphere of the galaxy rather than southern hemisphere, or something like that. We might, you know, cross the ecliptic or whatever it's called. But are we all going to die on the 21st of December? Probably not. It could be that we're all going through some spiritual change. You know, right. that we finally become the people that we were always intended to become. You know, people who give a shit about each other.
Right, right. Well, it
not, that would be nice.
That would be a step up, I think. Not that things haven't happened in Earth's history that affected the indigenous population. This thing has happened and been recorded in the geological record. So, yeah, I mean, it is possible that something could happen. I guess the question would be how would the ancients or the Mayans how would they know?
Well, yeah, how would they know? I don't know. I mean, how would they know that something like that's going to happen? Maybe by studying the stars over huge periods of time, they could work out that there would be the end of a cycle of some kind. Or perhaps they were told by other beings, maybe beings from other places.
Well, a lot of indigenous cultures talk about these sorts of things going back through history. The Sumerians and other cultures, the Dogons, and talk about being influenced and communicated to by gods.
From certain places that always seem to crop up, the same places, don't they?
Yes, they do.
That same star systems.
You know? Yeah.
And then you've got Planet X or Nibiru or whatever as well. I've had programs talking about that. And, you know, it could be that there is lots of knowledge on this planet from elsewhere that has been, you know, largely hidden and is there to inform us or warn us, perhaps. It would seem the end of a great experiment, a bit unnecessarily, for us all to die on the 21st of December, wouldn't it?
It would sort of ruin the whole point of the experiment, unless they're going to just wipe the slate clean and move on with a new experiment. But I oppose that decision.
So not you, then. you're not going to die.
I'm speaking for the entire human race when I say, no, I think we can pull our act together. Don't.
It's a possibility. It's hard to believe sometimes, though, isn't it? You know, that we could pull our act together.
Well, yeah, I mean, that does seem to be the case. It's like our warlike tendencies haven't really diminished that much. I would even maybe go so far as to say they've escalated. But that's just me. I'm sure other people would disagree. I think the effort to murder fellow humans has just become more technical. Has become the toys have gotten better. That's all.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The toys of destruction. But it looks like, I mean, if you look at the planet, there is evidence that there have been nuclear wars, of which we are, iteration of our civilization, that have, you know, blasted land into glass. Places like in India, for instance, even in Scotland.
Right.
It looks like there have been previously nuclear wars.
Really? I didn't know about Scotland, but I did know about India. I believe it got entire plains up to 3 inches to 6 inches deep of sand turned into glass.
Yeah.
But so I didn't know about Scotland.
Yeah, there are some places in Scotland, apparently, some like fortress sites that are glass, you know, they're turned to glass. So, you know, maybe there have been big wars. Maybe there have been, you know, if you look at things like forbidden archaeology, you know, Michael Cremer, we mentioned him earlier, you know, he talks about civilizations that existed before that we're not allowed to talk about or know about.
Right.
The falsification of history is a subject that I've dealt with a few times with various guests. And It's a very interesting subject.
It's fascinating, isn't it, that there's been stuff unearthed out of the jungles, old civilizations that's 12,000 years old. They find pyramids in Bosnia, a set of five main pyramids that are between 20 and 40,000 years old, with amazingly detailed structures going through them and tunnels. It's just amazing, really.
It is amazing. And I've interviewed a chap called Alan Wilson, who's a kind of iconoclastic historian, before, and I'm having him back on my show again next week, actually, 28th of February he's back on. And we're discussing his research into the lost tribes, the 10 lost tribes of Israel. He believes the Welsh people, and Wales, as you know, is west of England,
right,
on the British Isles, that the Welsh people are the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and that they made progress from Troy to the UK a good long time ago, and left monuments and writing and inscribed stones all the way, in the Colebrenne alphabet. And that even the hieroglyphs of the early Egyptian period, if translated into Welsh, make a lot more sense than the so-called official translations of what they mean. So, I mean, really interesting stuff. And there is grey evidence, you know, for instance, that there were two King Arthurs, not just one.
Oh, right, yes, I remember seeing a video on that. Brilliant, bloody interesting, because it may be the same person, I'm not sure, but he was talking about how you can find evidence for the cities that are spoken about in the Arthurian legend in the Welsh areas.
Yeah, that's probably him. That's probably Al Wilson. Yeah, he's a fascinating man, and he's done a huge amount of research. And the evidence is there in the old writings, in the suppressed history, which is never spoken because of interests, you know, like from the royal family, for instance, wouldn't like this truth to come out, if it is truth, that, you know, and they've tried to suppress it, but it's very hard to suppress stories about King Arthur because, you know, or the fact that there were two, because the King Arthurs were so famous that it's like they can't pretend that no one called Arthur existed.
Right.
So, you know, you get all this kind of myth mixed in with the real stuff and it becomes a sort of muddy mess deliberately.
Right, and you can't pretend that the forest that they're speaking about doesn't have the exact same name as the one in the historical reference.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's in ancient writings like Brutus. You know, the evidence is there already. There is all the evidence there. So anyway, he's coming on again, and we should have a great discussion. Hopefully, he's getting on a bit now, bless him. And he's written lots of books, but even they're hard to find.
Right. Yeah, I really enjoy speaking to people who've done a great deal of research, spent their lives almost as scholars, as, you know, I remember having Vincent Bridges on, and he was talking about the early alchemists. He was talking about John Dee and Sir Edward Kelly, which is the, you know, more of the European version of John Dee, which is Sir Edward Kelly, and he's over staying in Kelly's tower right now.
Oh, wow.
And they found a crypt underneath that had never been that had been closed for hundreds of years, and they're going to open it.
Well, that'll be exciting, won't it?
Yeah.
I hope they find something. It might just be empty, of course.
Well, I mean, it could be, but it's very interesting. I mean, and the history of it and the story of John Dee and Sir Edward Kelly. And this is the thing. He is a scholar. He's a researcher. And he spent, you know, years, decades looking into these things. And I love talking to people that have spent that much time looking into a subject or multiple subjects, because they're just, filled with information, and a lot of the times it's information that you don't get mainstream, and they're not making History Channel shows about it.
No, I agree, absolutely. I feel exactly the same way. I like to interview those kind of people as well, because, as you say, they've done the research and they can answer the questions and they can line up all their soldiers, you know, and they generally have something of great interest to say, and very often it has been suppressed, what they say. So yeah, it's very well worthwhile getting those kind of people on.
Yeah, I love talking to people who have worked in those areas. Okay, I wanted to ask you about the Holly Gregg scandal. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah, no, Holly Gregg, that's absolutely right, yeah.
And what could you tell me about that? What is the scandal about?
Well, I was the first person to interview Robert Greene, who's their representative, and Holly Gregg, she's about 23 years old, I think now. She's a, she suffers from, what do they call it? They used to call it Mongolism, but they don't call it that now. And her mother, Anne Gregg, and she was abused as a child by a paedophile ring. And one of the features of these people with her condition is that they find it very difficult to tell lies. And her mother complained when she discovered, including the people that had abused her for a long time, the powers that be in Scotland, where she was, refused to investigate properly, and yet she was awarded criminal injuries compensation, several thousand pounds, which is very odd if there's been no crime committed.
Right, yeah.
And Robert Greene is a kind of advisor, if you like, a researcher who has dedicated himself to forcing the government in Scotland to take it seriously and investigate. And he's had... have to be careful about this because there are legal implications. And he's been arrested. He's now in prison he's been given a year in prison in Scotland for breach of the peace. It's the most expensive breach of the peace case in history, costing millions. Mm. 9 months for breach of the peace and 3 months for breaking his bail conditions for simply planning to hand out leaflets in Aberdeen where he was standing for Parliament. He wasn't allowed to campaign.
Okay.
In Aberdeen, where he was standing for Parliament. First time this has ever happened.
Wow.
And what a single judge without a jury was able to send him to prison for a year just very recently. The situation is sort of unfolding at the moment. People are taking action to... do certain things to bring it to more attention. They have been campaigning.
It sounds a little bit like he was punished.
It does sound like that, doesn't
it? Yeah, his case sounds like it's a message. Don't support these people. Don't look into this subject. Or this will happen to you.
Yeah, well, that's right, because the people implicated in this are people with very senior positions and a lot to lose from it coming out that they're involved in paedophilia. So
these are known people. These are talking politicians.
Well, he's named these people. People have been named, whether that was wise or not, I wouldn't like to comment.
Right.
I've just remembered, of course, that Mongolism is Down syndrome.
Oh, Down syndrome, okay.
That's what it's called, yeah.
Okay.
The polite version of it. But anyway, she suffers from that. And
I suppose you're probably going to have him on your show when he finally does get out. You're saying he's serving a sentence right now, or do you think this has effectively shut him up?
No,
I guess that's the question.
I think that's probably quite unlikely.
Yeah, really? Okay.
He's a very brave man, Robert Greene. But some people have said that he's foolish for perhaps naming the names of those who allegedly abused Holly.
Right.
But, that's because they're in positions of power and they've used that power to try to silence him.
Mm.
It's a very, very interesting case.
Well, he was just stating the case, wasn't he? And he got punished for it, it sounds. Well, I'm certainly not going to let you go without asking you about the death of Diana.
Yeah.
That's your neck of the woods.
Well, yeah, I guess. Yeah, I interviewed an author called John King who wrote a book about the death of Diana, which was called Princess Diana, the Evidence. And he describes the methods that were used possibly to kill her. And it does look like her death was deliberate, because she was causing a lot of trouble for the royal family. You know, she was. It looked likely that she may have been pregnant and was going to marry a man who was a Muslim, and who, you know, would then be the stepfather of the future King of England.
Right.
So you can imagine there might be some embarrassment there for the royal family. So, you know, he lined up a lot of evidence that she was murdered by something called the Boston Brakes, which is a way of controlling the car that she was in to crash it into the Alma Tunnel, into the pillars in the Alma Tunnel in Paris.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been some speculation that it was also a ritual murder.
Well, it's that particular tunnel, above the tunnel, is a replica of the torch of the Statue of Liberty, which was a gift by the French people, allegedly. In fact, Eiffel, the guy who built the Eiffel Tower, was supposed to have designed it, I believe, the Statue of Liberty. And the torch of the Statue of Liberty is directly above where she died, or a reproduction of that torch. But in fact, it was given to the American people by Freemasons. And you can draw any conclusion you like from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another subject that sort of falls into the whole Freemasons, Rosicrucians, Illuminati. You've had people on your show talking about the Illuminati and the beginnings of the Illuminati in Bavaria, Weishaupt.
Yeah, 1776, which was the year, of course, that the United States was, well, independent. Wasn't it?
Just a coincidence, nothing to see here. Yeah.
Absolutely.
A lot of these things seem to form around numbers that are important or supposedly important to these figures in the New World Order, the Illuminati, whatever you appellation you want to give them, does seem to be important to them.
And the bankers and so on and all that. I mean, one of the people I interviewed is an American called Anthony J. Hilder. I'm sure you're familiar with him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He lives in California, I believe. You know, he's made lots of documentaries, including 9/11, The Greatest Lie Ever Sold, Illuminati, Frankenfed, about the Federal Reserve Banks, and so on. You know, so
things all tied together. The German connection.
In what respect?
Well, did he call it the Illuminati?
Oh yeah. I guess I guess because they're fascist, you know, but. There does seem to be links between the funding of participants in wars, including Adolf Hitler, by the same people who are funding both sides. You know, in fact, Prescott Bush, George H.W. Bush's father, was convicted of funding the Nazis.
Yeah.
So,
and then went on his merry way.
Well, yeah, pretty much.
Slap on the wrist. Little slap on the wrist. Oh, don't do that again.
Yeah, I mean, the Federal Reserve, there's a fascinating story about the Federal Reserve Banks and the Bank of England. The Federal Reserve Banks were established in 1913 by an act of the American Congress, you know,
a couple of guys that were there after closing, yeah.
Yeah, Christmas. It was Christmas.
Christmas Eve, wasn't it?
Yeah, and basically took away the right of the American people to issue their own money. So privately owned companies produce money from thin air and issue it as debt to the American people.
Yeah, it's craziness.
I'm pretty sure the same thing happens in Canada, but I don't have the facts and figures for that.
Well, what about England?
Sorry?
What about England?
Well, interestingly, the Bank of England was privately owned until 1946, just after the Second World War, when an Act of Parliament was passed nationalising the Bank of England. It was nationalised, and you would think, therefore, it would belong to the people of England. Well, people of Britain. But, in fact, there is another company called Bank of England Nominees Limited, which has secret shareholders, we're not allowed to know who they are, that basically controls the Bank of England. And the Bank of England doesn't publish any accounts, and you have no right to ask to see them.
And Bank of England Nominees Limited doesn't publish any accounts. And where they're based, in the City of London, City of London is like Washington, D.C.
Right, right.
Like Vatican City, a private, almost a private country.
Right.
The City of London, the square mile, is not actually part of the British Isles. Washington, D.C. is not part of the United States of America, and Vatican City isn't part of Italy. It's
right,
a private
exactly.
state.
Yep, yep, they are. That's true. That's
so, true. You know, yes, and money is issued a debt. I mean, if they only ever issue $1 or £1 and give it to a bank, say, and that bank has to then pay them back $1 or £1 plus 5% interest or 10% or any percent, where's that money going to come from? It's an impossibility. It will always be in debt. And that's how you control people, through debt.
Perpetual debt.
Perpetual debt. You can't possibly pay it back because they can never issue enough money. And all this quantitative easing that they're doing now, all it's doing is watering down the value of the money. When it was backed by gold or silver, it had a value. And you can exchange it for that value, but now it isn't. It's just, you know, it's issued as on a computer. It's meaningless, and you know, all the banks can issue money based on what they have in their vaults.
Yeah.
Fractional reserve banking. So they can have £100 and issue £1,000 or $1,000.
I want the same deal the banks are getting.
That yeah,
I can,
me too.
I can blow everything, and they'll just bail me out. They'll give it all back.
Yeah,
I would have. It would be a good time.
Yeah, yeah. I'm there with you any time, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, I can blow everything I have, go, you know, millions of dollars in debt, and they just go, that's okay, here you go. Here's what you lost and more. It's ridiculous, really. It's insane. The world is upside down. When stuff like that happens, you can take logical thinking people around and say, does this make sense to you? And they pretty much agree, no, that makes no sense. Let's not do that. And yet, these sorts of things keep happening. These crazy things just keep happening.
Yeah, well look at how everyone supposedly, all these countries around the world are supposedly in massive debt. Well, who are they in debt to? They're in debt to the banks that have been issuing fake money. How is that? How is that we're responsible for their debts, but they can keep their profits? That all the people in all the world are responsible for all the debts of all the banks.
Yeah, not only
they
that.
They can keep their profits. You know, we're pumping our money. We're having cuts in everything, and yet they can, you know, they can benefit from us giving them money, but and paying themselves huge bonuses.
I was going to say. Yeah, huge bonuses. They lose $50 billion, but they can give themselves a huge bonus at the end of the year. How does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's taking the piss, isn't it? That's what it is. It's taking the piss.
And it's in your face, too.
And we're so, you know, the people are so bloody stupid, with all due respect, because how can they possibly go along with it? How can they not be standing mutely outside Parliament and outside, you know, where is your Parliament? Ottawa, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, outside your Parliament and outside Washington and so on. Just standing there saying, we won't take this. Hell no. You know?
Yeah, hell no. Well, there's been a little bit of that with the, I'm sure you've been keeping up on the Occupy movement that happened. They got dampered a little bit because of the winter weather, and it's cold out now, and it's hard
and
to...
And they got sprayed with pepper gas.
Yeah,
pepper,
well, there was
spray.
That. Yeah, that'll slow you down a little
but
bit.
But a lot of them, you know, it's like once you go out there, it's like, I would say probably a third of the people out there are paid disinformation stooges for another agenda, you know, I would say.
Well,
and that's pure speculation, but I would say quite a significant percentage of those people are actually paid to be there to mess it up.
Sort of like suggest
stupid things, you know, to disenfranchise, to take away their power, you know, to emasculate them.
Yeah,
well, because of course they're not going to let it happen and be successful.
Right, it's diversionary. It's you know, they have a couple of slogans, but you know, the outrage is there though. That's one thing I did notice. The outrage of there's a lot going on in the world right now that is just plain wrong, and it needs to be fixed. So you can tell that that outrage is there and it is present. I just think that it's the – well, I've had people like Rob Paget on who talks about being a sovereign, and you've had people –
oh, yeah, I've had – yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a brilliant thing to look into when you're talking about common law and people are starting to get educated in these sorts of things, the Freeman movement, the common law, and, yeah. People are educating themselves about maritime law. Yeah. And all of that stuff. You know, of course, Jordan Maxwell's been doing that for four decades now.
Well, there have been lots of people, haven't they, in recent years doing it. And I've interviewed quite a few. I've interviewed people like John Harris and Veronica Chapman, who is author of a book called Freedom is More Than Just a Seven-Letter Word, and a chap called Guy Taylor I've interviewed, who's taken lots of legal action in court to try and prove that, you know, he's not a participant in some of these tax things. Because statute law in this country, and I'm sure in yours, is only law if it's with the approval of the people. So if you don't approve it legally, you're not covered by it. You're covered by common law, which is like, you know, you can't do harm to anybody, or you can't steal from somebody, or you can't kill people. That's common law. But statute law saying that you have to do this and you have to do that and you have to pay this fee and that fee, if you don't agree, technically, you don't have to pay, but of course, they're quite loath to accept that. The powers right. that be.
Right, right. And I mean, Canada, where I am, is just, well, we have the royal family on all of our coins, so I think you can pretty much figure out that Canada's pretty much owned by England. Or, you know, we wouldn't be having all of their faces stamped on our coins and our bills and stuff like that. Be people from Canadian history, maybe even the Indigenous population. We should have them stamped on our money because they were here first.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really interesting, isn't it, that Avatar didn't get the Oscar, even though it's by far the best film of the year. And, you know, the ex-wife of the man who made Avatar was given the Oscar for a pile of steaming poo that she made just to give him a kick in the... Yeah. You know, in a certain area, because it was about the stealing of the New World from the people who already lived there, you know, not just right. in Canada, but in Australia and the United States and Mexico and South and Central America and New Zealand. I mean, you know, half the world, basically, was stolen from the people who live there, who are the Navi, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
In that film. And that was what that film was about, and said it beautifully. But
exactly.
That's why I didn't get the Oscar. It was by far the best film.
Oh, I totally agree. It was telling the story of the Indigenous people and the people from the New World coming in and disregarding their traditions and their connection to the land. It was very interesting because you've got the people coming in and they were called the Sky People.
Yeah.
Right? By the Na'vi. They called them the Sky People, and they used technology, and the Na'vi had a connection to nature and had a connection to the land and had a connection to the trees, and they could interact with it. You know, they could interact with everything, whereas these people were completely divorced of that and totally relied on technology.
Within 100 years, you know, the Europeans had wiped out the buffalo across North America.
Yeah.
And wiped them out. They'd wiped out the most plentiful wild bird in North America, the passenger pigeon.
Yeah.
Of which there were thousands of millions of these, but they tasted delicious. So they destroyed them. They shot them all and ate them in New York restaurants and so on, you know. And they shot the buffalo. Well, they're actually bison, aren't they? But they shot them from trains.
Trains.
They built the train tracks in across America. They would stand on the back of the train shooting buffalo that would just lie there dead.
Yep. Target practice.
Target practice. You know, hundreds of pounds of meat rotting in the sun.
Yeah. No connection at all. None. No yeah. connection. It's just, it's like they're completely disconnected from the world around them, which yeah. is totally opposite them from the indigenous people, that when they do kill an animal, they communicate to that animal, which was shown in Avatar, that when she had to kill the animal, that she, you know, thanked the animal or prayed over the animal or whatever yeah. the case may be.
Yeah, she said, "I see you," and all that.
Yeah, right. So these sort of connections are outside of that. I'm wondering if we're getting more and more. I mean, where are we going to be in 100 years? How much tech? You know how much technology interacts with our life now.
Yeah. You know, and how controlled are we? You know, with they want us all to be chipped, of course. You know, so that all our money is on a chip that they can then turn off whenever they like to get at us. You know, so.
Well, it's a lot of. I mean, it's always been about control, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they moved the Indians, the Canadian and the American Indians, into smaller and smaller and smaller areas, breaking their contracts, which they had with the Indians, because they could, just because, well, it doesn't matter, you're savages anyway. And then the Indians had to move. Well, there's currently, and has been for decades now, the Indians have been fighting against that. And they're... Yeah. You know, it's a hard battle because the political structure just doesn't. They're disconnected. They're completely disconnected. But going back, of course, we're back to the psychopath thing again.
Keep well, back there. But it's true, isn't it? You know, it's the not only just lack of respect and honesty. It's just mindless murder. You know, the American Indian tribes were murdered, basically. They were slaughtered.
Millions of them.
Millions of them. And they were slaughtered, you know, and there was always a new excuse. You know, the Seminole Wars or whatever. You know, it was always a new excuse. You know, the Battle of Little Bighorn. And, you know, the savages would cut white men's hair off, you know, scalp off. Well, that was actually something that the white men did. It wasn't something that the Indians did. Until they learned it from us, you know.
They did it for bounty.
Yeah, they did it for bounty, absolutely. You know, how you get paid per scalp.
Absolutely, that's totally true, yeah.
So, you know, it shames us all, it shames us all. And, but, you know, and of course I know I'm in England, you know, and but I still feel the shame of that because we, you know, the English, you know, predominantly did this shit.
Right,
you know,
right.
Around the world. You know, we had an empire. Well, the sun never set on the British Empire, did it? You know, I have my grandfather was a captain in the Royal Navy, and I have his little pocket atlas. And all the areas on the map that were British, you know, at the height of the empire, are in red or pink, you know, pinky red. And it's basically the whole bloody world, you know.
It's just saying we own it all.
It's unbelievable how much of it was ours. You know, a huge chunks of Africa.
True.
Lots of Southeast Asia, you know, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, North America, chunks of South America, chunks of all of Canada, all of Australia, all of New Zealand. I mean, it's just endless.
Yep. Endless. And when chunks. It comes right down to it, it's not England that had the power. It's a very few select group of families.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. People who controlled the politics and the trading companies like the Dutch East India Company, for instance, you know.
Right.
Companies like that, but they would do the crime. It's just like now you have in places like Afghanistan, private contractors, private armies are doing all the business, if you like.
Right,
you know.
Right. And contractors that own those companies making huge profits and sending people out that are just pawns to die or to do the dirty work. You know, they don't do the dirty work. You know, they're too
busy. They're not subject to oversight or the laws. And they can do what they like, and they do what they like.
Right.
And power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Yeah, I think countries are, I think of them more as branch offices, like a bank. You have one central bank and then you have branch offices. Countries are the same thing. Countries are just branch offices, that's all they are. and the manipulation and stuff that goes on behind the scenes, like politics being the World Wrestling Federation of politics, you know. They pretend that they're enemies, and then they go have a beer, you know.
Yeah. Well, if you're a psychopath, you don't have any, you don't have second thoughts. You just do what you do to achieve the ends that you want to achieve, you know, and you have a little laugh with your friends. And you like to see people suffering. It gives you some kick, you know. These people get a kick from seeing people suffering and pretending they give a shit and they care.
Right.
Because they'll make all the speeches you like saying, you know, we're really concerned about this, we're going to do this about it. But then, you know, behind the scenes, they're just laughing. They're laughing at us.
Yeah, I think so. And mainstream media has them on there being very serious, talking about the issues and stuff, yeah. And then, you know, the camera goes off.
It's problem, reaction, solution, isn't it? They set up the situation so that they can get the end result that they intend. So there'll be something will happen. There'll be some, you know, disturbances or riots or wars or whatever. And the situation, you know, they'll set up something like, say, 9/11 so that they can bring in the Patriot Acts 1 and 2 to take away everybody's liberty. You know, what is it that the Americans fought for in the Second World War? Was it, you know, because it's home of the brave and land of the free, and they had liberty, and but they haven't defended it now, have they? Because they've lost it all. You know,
right.
President Obama has now signed an executive order saying that he can murder any American citizen or any citizen of any other nation without due process on suspicion of being a terrorist, whatever the hell that means.
Right. Loosely defined thing that he decides it is, yeah.
Yeah, so he can now murder people. And that this is a country that believes in the rule of law. I mean, excuse me? You know, it's bad enough.
Whose law?
Sorry?
Whose law?
Well, exactly. Whose law? You know. But not the Constitution, the American Constitution, you know. You know, I think the American people are... Well, they're walking into the FEMA camps, aren't they? I think a lot of people have often wondered how the Jews were rounded up and put on trains and cooperated with their being put on trains because they were told, well, they're going to, you know, a nice camp where they're going to do some work or whatever. I don't know what they were told, but they got on the trains without fighting. The American people and the British people, to some extent, and I'm sure the Canadian people, are now like those people, are now cooperating with their governments, while their governments put them effectively onto the cattle trucks.
Right. Yeah, I think Bill Hicks had a joke about that a long time ago, and it was, you know, what's that slapping against my ass? You know, oh, it's the government fucking me, right? So...
Bill Hicks was an extraordinary man, yeah.
I mean, he was speaking out... I mean, people are playing his videos on YouTube now, and hailing how he foreseen the future, and all he did was the same thing. What was his name? Carlin was talking about for years. Both Carlin and Bill Hicks were saying stuff that nowadays, if you're listening to the alternative media or the alternative researchers, have also been saying, you know, and they got laughs out of it, but we're not laughing anymore.
Well, yeah. I guess you're right. I mean, you know, if you look at this stuff and you realize just quite how bad it is pretty terrifying. It really is pretty terrifying.
It is.
And maybe that is what is happening in the year of 2012. Maybe it is that we're heading for some, you know, proper global awakening. Or maybe we've left it a bit too late. You know, maybe we're all going to be rounded up and put in the FEMA camps, and the population of the world will be deliberately reduced from 7 billion, if indeed it is 7 billion, and there's some question marks over that, down to 500 million. You know, maybe that's it. You know, maybe it really is the end of humanity as we know it. Maybe, you know, the psychopaths have won.
Yeah, I can see that, because if you look at it, and the rational mind wants to say that that's not possible, that they couldn't possibly do that, that we would fight against it, that we would not allow that to happen. Well, look how many things we have allowed to happen. And I'm not just talking about Canada or America or England. This is across the entire planet. Governments like corporations like the IMF have gone in
and the Bank of England International Settlements and the World Bank
have gone in and raped countries and, you know, just destroyed them.
Look at what's happening in Greece right now.
It's horrible.
It is truly horrible. And, of course, all these countries, once they get their hooks into them, they take all their assets. You know, what's happening in Libya now? They're taking all their oil. They're taking all their water. Anything that they have that's of value is now owned by private companies. The people have been robbed. You know, there was no...
Absolutely.
There was no revolution against Gaddafi at all. It was all engineered by the West.
Right. So when you say stuff like, I don't think that people would allow that to happen. Well, I think there's a great deal of evidence that says that, yes, people do allow that to happen.
Yeah, another illegal war. Another war of aggression has been committed by the West against a sovereign nation.
Right. And Iran is the next target on the board. And, you know, there's other targets, but...
Yeah, I mean, Iran's not perfect. It probably is also run by people who you might describe as psychopathic. And it doesn't do its own PR as best as it might. However, it is a sovereign nation. And, you know, Israel and the United States and the other countries that want to have a go at it have no right to invade it and to destroy it and to steal its assets. But, you know, as we said at the start of this this discussion, you know, the drums of war are beating ever louder.
Yeah, yeah. It, as if there isn't enough wrong in the world with the economy and everything else, this has to happen. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen over the next couple of years. I don't know what's going to happen in 2012. I'd like to think that there's going to be some sort of new awakening, some sort of consciousness expanding event or something that changes everything back. But looking at what's happening in the world right now and going back into history and taking that up till now, it's difficult to look on the sunny side of that.
There are people like Benjamin Fulford who talks about the white hats, you know, people within the Pentagon, people within the government, the army and so on, who are acting against these forces, acting because they've had enough. Now, I don't know if it's true. I've interviewed Benjamin Fulford. I don't know if what he says is true. I'd like to think it's true, but, you know, it's possible that it's not true.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would like to think that enough people are kind of waking up and going, you know, people who have actually some power, and going, you know, enough is enough. And there are other forces in the world, like the Chinese and like the Russians, who might stand in the way of the invasion of Iran because they have their own reasons for not wishing to see it destroyed, not wishing to see the oil that it produces going to America.
Right.
They would like to see it going east and north rather than west.
And do you think England will be involved as well?
Oh, absolutely, of course, because the Bank of England, you know, is still heavily involved. And the, you know, the City of London, the powers that be in the City of London, arguably rule the world. You know, arguably rule right. Washington and the Vatican, arguably. I don't know if that's true, but, you know, there is evidence that nothing has changed.
Yeah, for a long, long time.
Oh, exactly, a long, long time.
I don't think this is just decades. I think that there's more to it than that. I think it's a long-term project. If it is a project, I think it's a long-term one.
Yeah. There is something else. I mean, we're coming to the end of this now, aren't we?
Yes.
Scott, I was going to suggest a possible alternative for everything, really. It's not that the happiest idea, but it is an idea which is stuck in my mind since I first read it somewhere, some time ago, years ago, actually. And that is that everything in our reality might just actually be a computer program.
The Matrix.
Like the Matrix, but we might be some kind of social experiment running on, say, a university computer somewhere. If it were possible for a system to be developed, a computer type system to be developed, where all the elements within that system claimed that they were free and cogent and able to think for themselves and make choices. You could run lots of experiments, couldn't you? You wouldn't stop at just one. You would run thousands of experiments,
right,
of societies to find out what would happen. And you'd put things into those societies to change them. You'd put things like wars and politicians and corporations doing things and diseases and, I don't know, attacks by comets from outer space or aliens or spirituality, weird stuff. You could build... You wouldn't just build one alternative universe in this software, would you? Because you'd want to see what would happen if this happens or that happens.
Right.
So you'd build millions, and if that is possible, then the chances are that our reality is far more likely, because there would be so many of these fake programs running, that our reality is far more likely to be actually in a computer somewhere than it is to be real. I think that's pretty logical. And therefore, you know, I think there is a chance that actually all of this is just, you know, like you say, like the Matrix, but not real. It's not. I don't think we're like the people in the Matrix who were really there,
right,
you know, in a world that looked very different. We don't have to be real. We just could just be programs, you know, in a piece of software somewhere that we think we are free, and that we're able to make decisions and choices, and we can think and read books and stuff.
Right. We're interacting with the hologram.
Yeah, we're interacting with a hologram, and there's lots of evidence that our world is a hologram, actually, and that maybe it is like that. So maybe, and I know this is not very optimistic or nice, but it could just be that actually all the students are about to go home for the summer recess, and they're going to turn us all off. You know, so maybe December the 21st, 2012, is the day.
It's reboot.
It's reboot day. Yeah, we've run all these experiments. You know, I've got my PhD now. I'm going to, you know, I've been running, you know, a trillion different programs with different variations in them, all of which were designed by me and some other computers. You know, so all the people in them, like Scott, Jordan, and Theo Chalmers, you know, we're going to switch them all off. You know?
Wow, that's an interesting theory. Yeah.
It's possible, isn't it?
No, sure, it is possible. And absolutely. And I guess you could build into that program a death experience that would transcend death. Because, you know, I'm sure you've had people talking on about near-death experience and out-of-body travel and all of these areas. I mean, you can build
Peake
that.
Anthony Peake is a good example. Anthony Peake, P-E-A-K-E, the excellent thinker.
Yeah,
he's been a guest a couple of times. I recommend his books. Yeah, and what is the human experience? You know, he talks about the right brain, left brain thing. That in the right brain is this daemon, you know, this being that has lived our life previously and kind of can tell us what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And people do seem sometimes to know to duck at a particular moment when the bullet is flying.
Right.
You know, and there's all kinds of weird stuff like that. All it would explain all the weird stuff. Wouldn't it, living in this program? The weird stuff would be explained. Ghosts and poltergeists and...
Right, and out-of-body travel and near-death experience and UFOs.
Yeah,
and
all of that could just be a bit of fun that the students have come up with. Oh, what about this? Yeah, let's put that in there, see what happens. See how these people respond to this. You know, let's have a 50-foot-tall marshmallow guy. Oh, no, that was in the film, wasn't it? But, you know, they could do that.
Yeah. So they would be the sentient beings.
Yeah, they're the sentient beings, and maybe their world is pretty banal. Maybe not a lot of stuff happens.
Right.
But they have got these sophisticated computers that can, you know, allow us to think. You know, it's the elements within it. You know.
Curious to know where computer science will be in 50 years. I mean, it's hard to imagine. I try to look into the future and sort of project and say, well, you know, Michio Kaku's talked about the type 1, type 2, type 3 civilization. We're apparently a type 0 because we haven't made it, you know, off the using the resources off planet yet. And, you know, we're primitive, I guess, in a sense, because we're not traveling the galaxy and the universe. And, using, you know, we're still using coal and nuclear and, you know, burning stuff.
Old technology, yeah. Well, that's right. We are. We're using all this old shit technology, and we are. Maybe we are on the cusp of something like that. That's very different. You know,
yeah.
Maybe free energy or.
That would be nice. That would be nice. I don't see the powers that be allowing it to happen, but maybe they're going to have no choice. You know, I hope that that's the case. I truly do. I hope things just get better and better and better. And that's
my, so do I.
That's I. You know, I'm sort of I float. It depends on the Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. I'm an optimist. Rest of the week, I'm a pessimist.
But it's Sunday, Scott.
Yeah. Well. I do the half and half thing. Half the day I'm a pessimist, and half the day I'm optimist. I think we floated between both of those. The cusp time between those two, I float. I did the first hour as an optimist.
Second hour as a pessimist.
Yeah.
I would say that the in the final analysis, what it comes down to is ourselves, and that is all that we have. And, you know, like Gandhi said, be the change you want to see. You know, you have to live your own life. You have to be the person that you want the planet to have on it. You know, if you want the planet to be a better place, you can't start anywhere except yourself. And that's the only place you can start and the only place you can go, really. And I think that's the only lesson that I've taken from any of this.
Right, years know thyself.
Well, not just know yourself, and I think, of course, that's really, really important. But to be, you know, to be the truth as you see it for yourself, you know, to be, even just by telling people what you think and what you know, right. Maybe you can make a difference. Maybe, just maybe, we can make a difference. Just a small, small amount of difference. But the only way to do it is by starting with ourselves and not, you know, not doing anything else but starting with ourselves, and that's an ending with ourselves. It starts and it ends with me, and it starts and it ends with you, and so on.
Right, but you're a unique individual. You're sort of a seeker. You've had this overwhelming curiosity about stuff, you know, beyond your ken. Things that you don't know about that you want to know about. You want to learn more, and you have people on your guests. I look at my show as, you know, selfishly, I'm getting a lot out of this. If other people hear it and get something out of it, you know, more power to them. But I learn a lot by talking to the guests, and it's a constantly self-evolving thing.
Yeah, no, I said it. I mean, I'm incredibly honored that I have the opportunity to meet all these people, you know, these extraordinary people who've done so much and studied so much and learned so much and are prepared to share it with me and my audience, you know, and I am hugely honored and blessed that I have that opportunity.
Yeah. It's a great opportunity. I totally agree. I would like to end this with you talking about your TV show, if you have a website, anything that you have upcoming shows.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got shows every week. It's a live show every Tuesday on Sky Channel 200, which goes out across Europe. If you either on you can tune it manually, or you can go on the Sky satellite. You know, Rupert
right.
Murdoch's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got shows coming up. You know, there's only the next sort of three or so that are firmed up. So it's probably, you know. I don't really want to say who I've got coming up because not everything's
locked down.
You know, it's every week, Tuesday at 8 o'clock on Scott across Europe at 8 o'clock, or the following week on Wednesday at 9 is the previous week's Tuesday show. We have people texting in questions and stuff. They're 2 hour shows now with an hour on air and then an hour on the internet.
Okay.
Which is edgemediatv.com. So people can subscribe and watch that second hour.
Oh, good.
In fact, all of the show, in fact, edgemediatv.com. So even in America or Canada, wherever, you know.
Yeah, worldwide.
You are America, aren't you? Not like that country south of you, which is the country with without a proper name.
United States.
Well, it hasn't got a name. It's not a name. It's a description.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, get over yourselves, guys. Get a name, for Christ's sake. And how dare you call yourself America, because you're not.
Yeah.
You're a bit of America.
Yeah, just a wee bit.
Yeah.
Okay, so I appreciate your time. I very much enjoy talking to a superstar. It's always good.
Thank you, Scott.
And I hope to have you on again sometime. Everybody should be going and checking out his new show, One Step Beyond. And you can just type in The Edge Media, or you can type in is that show on the internet on its own website, or is it part of the Edge?
Quite a lot of my old shows are available on dailymotion.com /Theo Chalmers. Some of the On the Edge shows are on there, if people want to watch those.
Right.
And the current shows, you have to subscribe to watch them on edgemediatv.com. That's a good place to start, and you can find a place to subscribe on there.
Yeah, amazing guests every week. I don't know how you do it, but you're keeping very busy. And I appreciate your time, and thank you very much. And we'll catch you guys next week. Bye-bye. Hey, guys, how you doing? Have an exciting update today. We have Lloyd Pye with us, and he's going to be talking about partial analysis of the DNA that was done on the Starchild skull that reinforces the absolute proof that can be obtained that the Starchild skull is not human. So let's get right to it. Welcome, Lloyd.
Ah, thank you very much. It's good to be with you again, Scott, and I'm glad to be with your audience again to bring them this update about the Starchild skull DNA analysis.
Okay, so you've just recently found out some more extensive information on the DNA. Can you drill down a bit and tell us what the process was?
Well, the process all along has been for our geneticists to find some piece, some fragment within nuclear DNA of the star child that has some meaning. Now, let me explain how it works. In all of our cells in the nucleus, we have all of the genetic material that our mother gives us and all that our father gives us. That's 3+ billion. It's over 3 billion with a B, billion base pairs. It's an awful lot of base pairs. So out of that, about 95% of the 3 billion doesn't really work. It doesn't do anything that anybody understands at this point. And when I say it doesn't work, they call it junk DNA. Everybody's heard it. They call it non-coding, non-functional, or junk DNA. Everybody knows that term. In that, if you pull out a fragment in the junk, it's just not, you can't tell what it does. It has no purpose. But in the 5% that works, if you can pull something out of there, you can compare what the proteins are, what the proteins make. And so the geneticists came to refer to that area as getting a fragment out of there as the golden needle. The golden needle in the giant 3 billion base pair haystack. Mm-hmm. If we could just find some base pairs strung together into a fragment there, and then he would be able to do something with it and make a valid comparison against the human fragment of similar nature. So he's recovered dozens and dozens from the 95%, which were essentially not useless, but all they could do is run them through the NIH database, and it comes back either as recognized or not recognized in the database. Now, that was significant because when you have a lot of stuff that comes back not recognized, that's an indication it's not found on Earth. So that was significant in its own right, but not overwhelming. With the mitochondrial DNA recovery, it was the same way. He recovered 4 fragments out of the mitochondrial DNA, which amounted to 9.5%, almost 10%, which indicated strongly that the star child's number of mutations in the mitochondrial DNA were going to put it well away from humans. Humans have about 120 mutations maximum in their mitochondrial DNA. Starchild is going to be in the range of 800 to 1,000.
Chimps have 1,200, right? 1,500.
Chimps have 1,500, right. Yeah. So it's way, way away from humans. Not to chimps, but still no way you can call that human. Or even close. Neanderthal has 200. We have 120. Neanderthal has 200. Denisova, the new one, Denisova has 385. So, you know, that was significant too, but not overwhelming. The new one is overwhelming. He got a piece out of the working 5%. And that piece is called FOXP2.
Right.
The FOXP2 gene. Now, the significance of that is it's not just a functioning gene. It's a master gene that controls at least 300 other genes in what's called the downstream flow. In other words, what the FOXP2 does flows down to 300 other genes in our bodies. It controls them. It is a master gene. So what the geneticist said was it's not just a golden needle. It's a diamond needle.
No. So it's a very, very big deal.
Very big deal. So the fragment that he got was 211 of the 2,500, roughly 2,500 base pairs in the FOXP2 gene, all right? 211. Not a big fragment per se, but it laps over something very significant in the gene, which is a couple of peptide strings. So it's unmistakable that this comes from the star child's FOXP2 area and that the star child has a FOXP2 area. But understand that just virtually everything that's of a complex nature, of complex life, and we're talking down to the smallest little animals, has a FOXP2 corollary of its own. Why? Because it controls basically the formation as your body is being formed of your brain, of your throat, of your heart, of your lungs, of your guts, like the center part of your body, some of the most important parts, not your limbs, but those core functioning parts. FOXP2 has a role in that, and it seems to have a role like that in everything. So it's very, very important, and it's very, very highly conserved. And highly conserved means this: no changes allowed, because if you have a change in the FOXP2, if you have a mutation in the FOXP2, it's going to kill you. If you're being gestated with something goes wrong, mutates wrong, you're going to die probably in your mother's womb.
It'll abort.
Abort, exactly. So there's only a very, very few mutations known in this gene. One of the most famous ones, one of the best known ones, is if in the 2,500 base pairs, if you have one base pair different, one, you lose all capacity to speak ever. All right? It's that kind of deal. Now, with normal humans, Scott, and this is the key for everybody to understand, with normal humans, mm-hmm. we all have exactly the same array of base pairs in our FOXP2 gene. The 2,500 plus that we're talking about, all the same, exactly the same. With the star child, there are as many as 600 to 700 if you project out from the fragment. The fragment itself has 56.
Okay.
A monkey has two. You know, a rhesus monkey has two. A frog has 27. We have several animals outlined in the essay on the website. The point is, maximum for normal animals on Earth is 30 or less. The star in that 211 base pair fragment, in the star child it's 56. If you extrapolate that out to the full 100%, it's going to fall in the range
right.
of 600 to 700.
Because it was a partial.
Exactly. It's a partial. So the point is, there's no way to say this is a human, even close to a human creature, the star child. And now, we cover this base on in the essay that's on the website, the new essay that's on the website explaining all this, is that if a skeptic were to say, well, then it must be some kind of pseudogene, because it's so different, they're going to say, try to say, well, maybe it's just a pseudogene and that's it. Now, a pseudogene is genes that we do have in our bodies. Remember in that junk part of it, there are parts in the junk that seem to be genes that might have worked at one time, but they have been shut down for one reason or another and they don't work anymore. That's a pseudogene, basically. So they're going to say, well, okay, it's so different, it's so bizarre, it's so weird, must be a pseudogene. Okay, fine, except there are no pseudogenes in the human FOXP2 gene, no pseudogene. So if you say, if you attempt to say it's a pseudogene, you're right away saying it's not a human. So we have them boxed in on that one. You see what I'm saying? They don't have anywhere to move. They either have to accept it as radically different from human, or they have to call it a pseudogene, which ipso facto means it's radically different from human. So we're in the catbird seat here, Scott. We're in really, really good shape now. Not with science. Science is still going to completely ignore us. They're going to ignore us until we can produce the whole genome and every bit of it stem to stern shows that it's not human, which we know it's going to do. But this should put us in much better shape as we try to get speak to investors to try to get the funding that we need, the large amount of money that we need to recover the genome and create the two documentary films that are going to cover the two major parts of what that entails, the recovery of the mitochondrial DNA and the recovery of the nuclear DNA. So if everybody can just be, you know, patient a little while longer, we've been patient for 13 years. I hope that everyone can that's listening can be patient for a little while longer. But this is a very, very major development for us. We're very excited about it.
Yeah.
I feel like this is the one thing we've been needing to put us over the top and, you know, just have to continue on with what we're doing.
I figured it was when I read the update. I figured, oh, this is a big deal. I should probably talk to Lloyd about this.
Right.
How can you be sure that the genetic sample has not been contaminated in some way?
Well, you know, it's just contaminated by what? I mean, what is going to – okay, it's contaminated by an alien because it's so different, Scott, what we have. But it isn't contaminated because it is a piece of FOXP2. It is a piece of FOXP2, and not only that, it is a piece of human FOXP2 because it has those two peptides. And what they are, basically, they're called polyglutamine tracts. I don't want to confuse anybody, but if you look, and it's on the website, you can see the string. We have the 211 base pair string compared to a few other animals, so you get a range of how this that compare to their FOXP2 in that 211 base pair string. And, of course, you see a human as well, and what you see is in the human there is 40 straight glycines. You'll see GLN, you'll see that 40 straight of them. Then there's six different ones, and then there's another string of 10 more glycines in a row, and these are amino acids, and you have to be looking at that diagram to understand what I'm saying, but it's there. You can see it for yourself. Well, those same exact stretches are found in the Starchild fragment that we have, but the Starchild, instead of having what the human has in the other amino acid positions, it has a lot of glycines as well, extra. More, and then the first four amino acids going into that stretch of glycines and the three that are left coming out are all different. And you just don't have differences in humans. So everything about this says that it's coming from the Starchild's FOXP2, but everything about it also says it's not like anything approaching a human. So we feel like this is very strong, though partial. Everybody needs to understand partial, but incredibly strong partial evidence indicating that all we have to do is recover the whole genome, and we're going to be looking at an alien genome.
Karen, okay, that's great. How much would it cost for DNA to be sequenced by, you mentioned this in your article, the next generation?
It's going to be a couple million dollars at least. Now, here's why. Everybody sends me these emails. Every time there's a new announcement about an improvement in the sequencing and a drop in the cost of sequencing, it's down now. You hear some new next generation builders, you know, people who build machines in the next generation, saying it's going to be down to $1,000 before long. Well, that's true. And it's all applying to live, living DNA, my DNA, your DNA,
right.
A living body's DNA. fine. That's great. But that's when all the base pair, all the genes, everything is strung together properly. And so the machines can just go down the line and pull out the base pairs and read them, and everything's great. But unfortunately, the star child remains dead. The old Chevy Chase thing. He's still dead. The dictator of Spain's still dead. Star child's still been dead for 900 plus years.
Okay, so that answers my next question, was how long has it been around?
Yeah, its DNA is very, very badly degraded, very, very badly contaminated, which all, it's ancient DNA. It's called ancient DNA. Anything over 50 years technically qualifies as ancient DNA. And so the reason that it's going to cost so much is what you have to do is make those runs through those machines literally dozens of times, so that you pick up, in one run, you'll pick up X number of fragments. In another run, you'll pick up X number of fragments. Won't always be the same amount of fragments. In another run, you'll pick up another X amount of fragments. Again, some will be in the first two, some won't be in the first two. You have to do this dozens of times until you fill every hole. And that's what takes the time, and that's what takes the money. And so it's just, it's unavoidable.
So it's a multiple.
It's in the end, what you do, Scott, is you take, let's just say 30 for an example, because that's what they're tending to do now with the samples that they're doing of Neanderthals and Denisovans and things like that. So let's say they're 30. We're looking at 30 runs of the star child through the next generation machines, whether it's 454, whether it's Illumina, whether it's Eon Proton, or whatever. And then you lay those 30 down, 30 lines on a row, and then you squeeze them down, you compress them until you make you fill in every hole that you can in that genome. And then you're looking at one line with everything pretty much accounted for. And that's where that's when you say, okay, here's what we have, and here's where it's different from humans. And the geneticist has been saying from the very beginning when he got first results, he says it looks like it's going to be between 50% and 10% difference from the human genome. Now, understand what that means. A chimp is about 2 to 3% different. 97 to 98% of a chimp genome is the same as ours. 95% of a gorilla genome is the same as ours. So understand what this means. The star child, he thinks, is going to fall in the range of 10% to 50% away from us. Now, if you're that different from a chimp or a gorilla in your whole genome, there's no way to call that any kind of an aberrant human. That's an alien. Right. So, people say, well, how can you prove it's alien if you don't have an alien genome to compare it to? We're going to establish the alien genome to compare things to in the future. Compare the coneheads to. That's very important. The coneheads are out there. They don't look human. And it's going to be very important to have that as a baseline when it comes time to start doing this to the coneheads. So we're very excited about it.
Yeah, I'd be excited to see what the conehead DNA comes up as.
It's going to be much closer to human DNA, I can tell you right now, because the coneheads have much more human-like faces than does the star child, which has a very different – I mean, it's kind of human-ish, but it isn't human-like, really. Right. But the coneheads are. They're different. They're clearly different. They have those brains twice the size of ours. They have some very significant differences in the jawline, et cetera. But I think in the end, the coneheads are going to fall closer to human than will the star child. The star child is going to be, the reason it's such a good thing for the star child to go first is because it's going to be so far away, there's just going to be no argument.
I remember years ago when we were emailing back and forth, it was maybe the mother was alien, or maybe the mother was human, and the father was alien.
Right.
And it sort of has been bouncing around over the years, but now it's looking more towards both parents being
alien. Exactly.
Alien.
No question. Yeah, for a long time, we had to go on the result of the 2003 DNA test, which indicated that the mother was human and the father was not.
I remember that.
But the test in 2003, the test still, you could only use primers. Now, with the next generation, with the new stuff that pulls out base pair by base pair, you get a much more accurate read, and we find out that the test in 2003, while accurate for its time, it was not completely accurate as not as accurate as it could be, and so it while we believed it for a long time that it was a hybrid, it really isn't. It's all the way alien.
Yeah. Okay. So very significant update. We know that we got a pretty good idea that it was the Star Child was around 900 years ago.
Right.
So we're not talking super ancient, like 10,000 years ago
or
anything.
No degree of fossilization in the bone or anything. It's just bone and really, all things considered, for something dead that long, it's reasonably well preserved because it was buried in a mine tunnel. So it isn't, you know, it isn't.
And that helped.
Oh, a lot, absolutely.
So the samples that they're getting are good samples. The
very, very good for ancient DNA. They're good, clean samples. Exactly.
Okay, great. Can you just give everybody your website where you've got the latest updates?
So for those who want to read the new essay up that's about this, it's on the StarChildProject.com website, www.StarChildProject, all one word, .com. And when you go there to the homepage, you'll see a grid of icons to the right. The second one from the top says DNA, and in brackets, new DNA, DNA, new. Click on that, and you'll go right to the essay. Now, the essay is 4,000 words. It'll take you about 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes, depending on how fast you read. It's got several good illustrations that make clear what's happening, but particularly you need to check out the FOXP2 laid out against the human and the other animals so you can see for yourself the importance of this and the differences in the Star Child versus the human. You'll see the human stretched out in there in all blue, and you'll see the Star Child differences in red, and 56 are red out of 211. If it was 212, and if there had been one more base pair that was the same as the human and 56 differences, it would be exactly 50% different. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
so when he said 10 to 50%, when we saw that number, you know, because we always believed it would be up closer to the 10% than the 50%, but just this little fragment of FOXP2 indicates it may be closer to 50% difference. So it's astounding, Scott. It's just astounding.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's definitely, I've been following this, like, you know, for a long time, and it's a very big deal that this has happened. So what's the next step? I mean, I got to ask, is the technician that you have doing the lab work, the person who's made themselves available to do this, are they doing it pro bono for you, or are they just sort of...
Pretty much. When it gets really expensive, we get we have donations that come in pretty steadily, and we apply those to it. But he does his time is all his own. We just simply pay for the reagents and the chemicals, which are expensive to do this kind of stuff. We pay for those, but other than that, he does it on his own time, generally on weekends, and a lot of it does come out of his pocket. But we all know what we're working for. We all know that we're going into the history books with this, so it gives you motivation that you wouldn't ordinarily have.
Think that some huge university would just jump all over this and pay for everything.
Well, once we have it proven, then they'll be in line, hat in hand, please, please, please.
Yeah.
You know? But until then, until somebody takes that first step and it's safe for them to do that, because if they tried to do it now, they get their heads chopped off by the conservatives out there,
right?
Conservative scientific peers, who absolutely do not allow anyone in science to pretend that that UFOs and aliens are real in any way. So it's just a psychological war that is waged by the conservatives in every field. I mean, just in every field. In all of life, there are those people who want to live in the future and those who want to live in the past. It's in politics, it's in government, it's in religion, it's everywhere. There are those who want to live in the future and those who want to live in the past. And, of course, I'm among the group that want to live in the future, and some scientists and some politicians and some religious leaders and all want to live in the future as well. But they are always overwhelmed and intimidated by the number and the virulence of those who want to live in the past.
I totally agree. Well, thanks, Lloyd. I appreciate you coming on, giving this update. Very important stuff going on. What's next?
Well, we take this information, this new data out, and we now start presenting that to investors, and we find the one who's going to say, you know, you're right, this is really powerful enough, let's go ahead and get it done, and then we'll be off to the races.
Okay, thank you. And keep me updated. Next time you have a big release, let me know. I'll put it out there, and we'll just let the people know what's going on, because I think the information needs to be out there on what you're doing. And more power to you, Lloyd.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you. Talk to you again sometime.
Okay, have a good one. Bye-bye.